Okay.
Well, first of all, let me start by thanking Will. I think this is an incredibly important topic, and I come at this from many different angles, but what I want to do here is, in a way, give you kind of my general framework about how I think about the time and temporality generally. And it comes from a standpoint that's, in a way, it does relate to what Barbara has just been talking about, but it's really quite different, I think, in terms of its kind of spin and so forth. So, for example, one of the things I was very struck by what Barbara said was when she was talking about how we're living through the futures of the past that didn't materialize, and in some sense we're kind of picking up the pieces afterwards and so forth. And she put this in a way that was, I don't want to say pessimistic exactly, but I would say certainly stressing a kind of burden that we have from the past. Now, this kind of idea, when I listen to it, and again, taking out kind of the sociological context in which it's being presented, this was kind of the idea that was put on the table by people in the Protestant Reformation with regard to how we think about original sin. Okay? So original sin is the burden that we inherit, and in a sense, all of the actings out that have taken place over the course of history, right, are people in a way living through that. And so we then have a kind of responsibility, whether or not gets fulfilled or not, is to somehow overcome that. And we're not the ones who decide whether it ever gets overcome. God does. But nevertheless, we have this kind of responsibility. And the interesting thing about this kind of viewpoint as it developed, you know, in the Protestant Reformation, largely out of Calvinism, but then it becomes the doctrine of progress, okay, by the time we get into the 18th century, when it's secularized, because what it does is it basically leads to a fundamental distrust, dislike for things that have always been the way they are, even if they've been stable, even if they've been traditionally grounded. Because insofar as you take seriously and literally the idea that we are constantly reproducing original sin, then even if things seem quite fine and, you know, I can live with the king, I can live with the church, you know, they're not messing with me on a daily basis, nevertheless, they too are part of the depraved state of humanity. Okay? And so then there's a kind of special obligation with regard to how one thinks about these, you know, this kind of past as being one to overturn. So in other words, the presumption gets changed. It's no longer a matter that the past is presumed to be good unless shown otherwise in the way in which people operate. And here I would say, you know, think about somebody like Thomas Aquinas, right? Thomas Aquinas says there is a right to revolution that people have, but it's only if the king or the lord does something bad. Otherwise, the presumption remains with the lord and the king. And then once you've had the revolution, you basically have to find the right person to succeed him because the monarchy is a good idea. Okay? So in other words, there is this kind of, so with Thomas Aquinas, there is this kind of presumption, right, that the past, in a sense, isn't just so riven with original sin that everything about it needs to be considered critically and suspiciously and so forth to be potentially overturned, but rather it's only kind of on the margins with regard to your experienced life. So if the particular king or the particular lord is bad to you, then you have a right to revolt, but you don't have a generalized right to revolution that somehow comes from the sense in which authority is holding you back in general. Now, that view that Thomas Aquinas had relied on a very strong belief that the past wasn't a bad thing, right? At least presumptively wasn't a bad thing. Now, what we get, though, in the modern era through the Protestant Reformation and then secularized through the doctrine of progress is the idea that the past should be regarded with suspicion prima facie, even if it's not doing anything particularly bad to you. Okay? Now, this seems to me a very fundamentally different attitude toward which we, as looking forward into the future, have toward the past than, let's say, what Barbara was presenting. And I am actually a defender of this progressive viewpoint. Okay? I'm not postmodernism, notwithstanding. I my career began at the beginning of it, so I'm immune to it by this point. Right, but there is a sense in which that the progressive project in sense needs to be you might say re-understood and re-grounded in some way. Okay, and so this is kind of the general horizon from which I'm coming from. Okay, now it's interesting, of course, because this view that I've just kind of sketched out very briefly, that is my own starting point, is one that when it was presented in the 16th century was actually presenting the human condition as much more depraved than, let's say, the Catholic Church was presenting, a la Thomas Aquinas. But then by the time you get to the 18th century, it's seen as this great emancipatory, liberatory movement that justifies revolution and doing radical new things all the time and all the rest of it. Okay, so in a sense, the kind of valuation of the human condition in this general kind of viewpoint, which is suspicious of the past, right, starts to change during the modern period. It goes from being a recognition that we're stuck in original sin and then becomes kind of an obligation that we have to get ourselves out of it. Okay? And so this is the kind of viewpoint that, in a sense, I'm very much interested in reintroducing, reinvigorating, whatever. And in this context, in a lot of my recent writing with regard to Humanity 2.0, which is this thing I've been working on the most in the last few years, and it's one reason why I didn't want to talk about Academic Caesar, because that's kind of part of a longer standing concern I have about the university and the nature of knowledge. But with regard to the Humanity 2.0, we basically have two different sorts of attitudes, you might say, to the future relating to the past, and these are expressed obviously as attitudes toward risk. And so I want to put these on the table. Some of you will already know this from my writing, but it again helps to frame what I'm saying. And that is the precautionary and the proactionary attitudes. For purposes of this, I mean, the general difference in perspective, the precautionary principle is a principle, a kind of do no harm principle, as it were. A sort of principle that is enshrined in European Union legislation with regard to health and environmental concern, especially with regard to the introduction of new innovations, right? That in a sense, one has to be sure one is not doing more damage than whatever benefit is being promised by the innovation, right? This is the precautionary principle, right? And it's a kind of do no harm principle from Hippocrates extended universally, you might say. But then there's this other attitude, which is the proactionary attitude, which, if you want to put it in a kind of vulgar way, is no pain, no gain, right? That there's a sense in which the only way in which we do make progress is by acknowledging that there is going to be some harm, some heartache, and so forth. And so then the issue becomes, how do you calculate that effectively? And again, in both cases, we're talking about keeping the future in view. Both views are future-oriented, okay? But there is a difference with regard to the amount of harm and actually change, you might say, that might be tolerated. Now, when the precautionary principle gets introduced in the early 19th century, it's introduced in Germany as a principle of scientific forestry, which is to say, you cut down a certain number of trees, you want the same number of trees to be around. That's the context in which it's originated. And this had to be understood in the context of, you know, encroaching industrialization and all this stuff that was already happening in the beginning, you know, of the 19th century in Germany. And so the idea is that you're trying to guarantee some kind of stable equilibrium so that the future generations have exactly what the past had, at least, right? So that you're creating this kind of sense of sustainability, a kind of parity across generations. And I think this kind of intuition, however it's cashed out, I think is very much part of what the precautionary principle speaks to. The interesting thing about this kind of idea is if you contrast this with the proactionary principle, what I think you see here is a kind of difference in attitude toward the concept of what is possible, especially what is possible with regard to what human beings can do, okay? In philosophy, you know, there is this there is this branch of philosophy that's part of logic that has to do with modality, right? And this is the logic surrounding terms like possible, impossible, contingent, necessary, right? This cluster of terms, how they relate to each other. And so this is the context in which this argument arises. And if you go back to the 13th and 14th centuries, when you start to get articulated in a formal sense some kind of notion of the logic of the possible, you start to begin to see a kind of sea change, which really starts to, you might say, shift the presumption already from a kind of precautionary to a proactionary attitude. Because if you look at somebody like Aristotle, for example, and when he talks about what's possible, he's generally talking about what's probable. Okay? In other words, he's talking about something that already has a historical precedent. Right? That's the basic notion of possible for Aristotle. And this then gives a kind of presumption of reality. The fact that something has already happened, that's already been there, that's already got some kind of existential standing, that is where the possible begins. And so when you're thinking about what's possible in the future, right, in some sense you're thinking about a kind of extension of that. Right? What you're certainly not doing is presuming that the past might be something you might want to wipe the slate clean of. Right? You're not doing that, that's for sure. Possible doesn't include that. Okay? But what you start to get when you get into the 13th and 14th century is you get a kind of different conception of the possible. I think a conception of the possible that I think we're much more familiar with in the way we use the term nowadays, which is basically, conceivable, right? Or logically possible, as it's sometimes called, right? Where in a sense what you're drawing on when you're thinking about what's possible are elements of things that have, in a sense, existed in the past, right? So as it were, you're putting together stuff from the past. It's not like you're just making it up, in some kind of completely out of nothing way, but rather the combinations of things is novel, right? And as it were, so if you're thinking about things like the Golden Mountain, and there are these examples that philosophers, especially in the late 19th, early 20th century, started to get very exercised about their existential status, right? These kinds of things that are possible objects but do not exist, right, are typically made of properties of things that do exist, but as it were, pitched in a new way, combined in a new way. Now, where does this kind of way of thinking about possible come from? Well, I'm afraid we're going to have to talk about theology here, okay? Because basically what we're talking about getting into the mind of God and how God puts things together, okay? And that's what these guys were about back in the 13th and 14th century, right? So in other words, part of this project of trying to redefine what the possible is, right, is in a sense to scope out what the sphere, right, of divine conception and divine creation is. Much of it may not yet have been realized because we're humans after all, and from an empirical standpoint, we can't see everything right now, and we haven't, and we only know at best what we know from the past, right? From a purely empirical standpoint, even with perfect memory, we do not have the full point. We don't have the full record here of creation, as it were. But suppose you're trying to understand what that record is. How would you go about logically scoping it out? Well, this is the context in which the concept of possibility that we have, our modern concept, comes in. Namely, you sort of imagine that, in a sense, what God is doing is working with, we might call, logical atoms, semantic atoms, that is to say, properties of things that have already been exhibited in the past, but will be recombined in some way in the future. And as it were, we can try to figure out what those things are. And if you look at a lot of the projects of modern science, right, whether we're talking about the periodic table of elements or any of these kind of schemes, as it were, to divide up all of nature into different parts that can be recombined in various ways. We often associate this with the mechanical worldview, whatever, Obviously, computational theory is very much indebted to this line of thinking, too. This is where you start to get this modern notion of the possible from. And so once you start thinking along these lines, right, then what this does is it sort of shifts your attitude toward how you think about time. Okay? Because I think one way you can characterize the way in which you might say, if I may be, again, stereotyping, vulgarizing traditional society, and I would include actually even Thomas Aquinas's very sophisticated rendering of Christian doctrine in this category, right? There is a sense in which, from that standpoint, we know the past much better than we know the future, right? And that the future, in a sense, is incredibly risky and dangerous if we don't, in some sense, respect or repeat the past. Okay? Conservatism, right? We understand this as a political doctrine. This is rooted in this kind of metaphysical way of seeing the world. So even though there are changes and there are disruptions and there are things like that that, of course, happen over the course of history, right, these things are in a way temporary ruptures from a kind of natural norm that we have already seen in place. So whenever you think about the outcomes of revolution prior to French Revolution, at least in terms of the French Revolution's rhetoric, right, or the American Revolution, I think I put that in the same category there, right, prior to those revolutions of the late 18th century, the point of revolution was restoration. Right? You wanted to restore a natural order, which you already know, but which has been violated by some various acts of various people at various times, but then you return to equilibrium. Right? That's the conservative view. That is a politically conservative view, right? And it seems to me the precautionary principle is very much indebted to this, and I think it's the ecologically conservative view. All the sustainability stuff, in a way, I think is very much indebted to that kind of intuition, but now understood in terms of geological timescales. Right? And so from this standpoint, especially if you believe in something like a kind of Gaia hypothesis, or, you know, where the human being is potentially some kind of blight on the ecosphere, right? You know, we caused some problems and some disruptions for a little bit of time, you know, from the Industrial Revolution, let's say, if you believe in the Anthropocene, to what? Maybe the end of this century, and then we're gone, right? But then we go back to normal again. Right? This is, you know, so this kind of way of thinking, right, which basically presumes that we know the past actually much better than we know the future if we think the future is going to be different. We have to sort of assume the past pretty much sets the standard for us. It sets the normative standard. And we got relatively little wiggle room in which to operate productively within it. Okay? That's the conservative worldview. That is the view of the precautionary principle. And this is all the Anthropocene mongering going on, is very much of this kind. Okay? I mean, you know, so to put that there, you know, as kind of the, you know, you might say a challenge for people who think of that somehow these kinds of views that we've been talking about are progressive. They're not progressive. In fact, I think you might say it behooves the people who believe in these very, you know, relatively radical green perspectives to just say, I'm anti-progressive. Right? This isn't, you know, forget about progress. Progress is a nightmare, okay? You know, it's gonna do us in, and it's what's been doing, and so in other words, you're condemning both the liberal and the socialist version of this, right? Because progressivism, I think, is very important to, you know, in terms of the way in which contemporary politics is so muddled, right? What we're talking about is this general idea that somehow we can re-engineer, either through the market or through the state, that we can somehow re-engineer our societies and so that we can start, as it were, rebuilding and improving in a very fundamental way where we are. Okay, and that's the progressive viewpoint, basically, right? That everyone who's ever espoused a progressive viewpoint, whether we're talking about the capitalists or the socialists, they typically have a very kind of deep theory, as it were, about what people are like. Right, which enables you then to intervene strategically, whether we're talking about at the level of the laboratory or the level of the neighborhood or whatever, to, you know, change the opportunity space for people, basically. Right? I think this is true for both the liberals and the socialists. Right? So in other words, it goes back again to this kind of medieval idea where we have a kind of sphere of the possible that has only been partially realized historically. And what we need to do is actually to exploit the unrealized possibilities. And of course, if you said that back in the Middle Ages, people would be saying you're getting into the mind of God and you're doing God's work. But of course, this is pretty much what the state market does these days in a very invisible or visible way, right? It's a sort of the same thing going on, basically, okay? And in terms of the amount of, now the interesting thing is the amount of confidence that's invested in our capacity to do this kind of re-engineering, where you're basically creating spaces and opportunities that previously had not existed and actually end up disrupting people from the kinds of lives they've led, well or poorly, up to that point. Okay? So I'm implicating development aid in the progressive project as well, right? All this stuff about we're gonna change the third world and all this and bring them up to our standards. Same sort of thing going on here, okay? Now, the interesting, how much more time do I have? I don't wanna lose track.
You have 20 minutes.
20 minutes, okay, this is with a 40 minute talk. Is that the idea? Okay. I don't think I'll take this long, but we'll see. We'll see, if I do go to 40,
18,
let me know.
18 minutes.
Okay, well look, if I go to 40, let me know, okay? I know, you don't wanna get me started. I mean, I want to now step back a little bit and do a kind of, you might say, before and after image of the epistemology of time as it appeared before this kind of modern transformation that I'm talking about with regard to the reconceptualization of the possible. As I was saying, when I was just now discussing about the precautionary principle and the sort of views of Thomas Aquinas and the kind of default conservatism that people had generally, the idea here was that we know the past much better than the future, that the past is actually grounded. It's already happened. It's already there, right? And that the future is this kind of open space that's fraught with risk if we do not rely on the past. So in other words, this kind of viewpoint is a viewpoint that you might say is very, very heavily freighted with an inductivist mentality, right? Those of you who are familiar with the inference, right? The idea of induction is, right, that the future is going to be like the past. This is the best option. This is what you should naturally be predicting, right? Now, in the modern period, though, this kind of asymmetry, right, where in a sense you say we know the past very well, but we don't know the future at all, and that scares us to death, and so therefore we have to rely on the past, right, that difference reduces. This is the point I want to make about what happens in the modern era, right? That the difference between our knowledge of the past and our knowledge of the future reduces, so that in an ideal way, they become sort of at equal level. Okay? Now, what does this mean? Well, let's look at the past for a moment. One of the things that I think is very characteristic of the way in which the modern era has dealt with the past is the fact that it has been, you know, what we can think about this from the period of the critical historical theology in the 17th, 18th century, starting with Spinoza moving forward, right? This idea that the kinds of verities of the Bible, right, the kinds of things that we thought were handed down from time immemorial, right, start to get put under critical scrutiny. And one of the consequences of doing, I mean, this was already present in the Reformation, by the way, as people started to read the Bible and the sacred works in their original languages and started to think through things for themselves, is the fact that the past may not have been as we thought, and there may in fact be, you might say, multiple pasts available to you on the basis of which you might be able to legitimate your contemporary and future practices. And this was incredibly important for the development of Protestantism, of course. Right? Where Protestantism, in a sense, you know, it's kind of like everyone's got their own interpretation of the Bible, and you're allowed to do that, and you feel it, you know, and what you do is you eliminate the certainty of what the past has said as a general kind of overall point. So even though particular Protestant sects might say, no, I believe this reading of the Bible, no, I believe that reading of the Bible, nevertheless, the overall effect, right, is to deconstruct the certainty of the past. And that's very liberating. This is my point. This is a very liberating thing, because then there becomes open and available to you alternative ways of justifying what you think is, in fact, an appropriate way to live. Okay? So that's a very important point. Now, what you're having also on the other end with regard to the future is, I think, in a way, a much more kind of straightforward, obvious point is that you actually start to get, you might say, procedures, practices, methodologies, justifications of prediction, right? Which, at least to the satisfaction of the people doing them, work in some sense, at least to keep on promoting them, right? So there's a sense in which the future is not just this sort of logically scopable space that the medieval philosophers thought, but it becomes something that in some sense you can test, you can quantify, you can chart out, you can map out, you can talk about differences between short-term and long-term horizons, right? All of this kind of stuff, which I think is very much part of the taken-for-granted language of policy discourse in the modern era, is very much indebted to this idea that the future is not terra incognita. Even if we get it wrong a lot of the time, it's not terra incognita. It is something that can be explored, can be determined, can be controlled. Okay, and this is true even today. Otherwise, we wouldn't be commissioning scientific research to deal with things like climate change. Right? Because there's a sense in which we feel that if the more we know, the more we can control. Now, of course, people have disagreements with this, but the interesting point I would raise is that that whatever debates you want to have, it gets conducted on this terrain, right? In other words, there is a sense in which there is a presumption that we can actually talk about what a rational thing to do is with regard to the future, and we can have several options on the table, and we can compare them and measure them and do whatever. We may get it wrong, but we feel we can do that, right? So there's a kind of facility, right? I don't want to call it expertise because I don't believe there's expertise here exactly. But what there is a kind of confidence, sort of epistemological confidence, that even when we do make mistakes, we can be, you know, improve along the same lines. Okay? Now this seems to me very interesting, because what this means is that the future, from being originally this kind of completely terra incognita source of fear if we don't reproduce the past, becomes actually this sort of mappable space, you know, kind of like exploring a new planet or exploring the other side of the world or something like that. It becomes kind of more like that, right? Whereas the past is no longer providing this kind of absolute sense of legitimacy and authority and foundation, but rather opens itself to the possibility of discretionary interpretations, which in turn can license alternative ways of being. Okay? So this is where I think we are at the moment, as a matter of fact, okay, with regard to the state of knowledge in the world. And I think what is going on here, you know, in terms of what the moderns, as it were, have been trying to do, if I may, is that this was kind of their way of what it means to get into the mind of God. Okay, and I want to say a little bit about the mind of God for a moment. There won't be any sermons or anything here. Pure epistemology, don't worry. Now, there is a kind of image. Now, you might say, the mind of God, what could that be, right? But clearly, physicists think they're getting into it, right? Stephen Hawking, even though he's an atheist, thinks he gets into the mind of God. And this is a very common kind of turn of phrase that you have throughout the modern era, especially with regard to physics. And it's not by accident that it comes from physics, because the idea here is that, in some sense, human beings could rethink God's thoughts, especially with regard to the fundamental principles of creation. That is kind of that's what Newton was up to. So even though we realize nowadays that Newton's physics was limited with regard to what it actually encompassed, nevertheless, the mentality that informed it remains very much intact, it seems to me, okay? And so this whole thing for the grand unified theory of everything, right? This is still very much on this Newtonian tip. Now, Newton, as was common with people in this period, we're talking about the 17th century with Newton, had this kind of idea of God, you know, what is God's perspective, right? What Thomas Nagel talks about, the view from nowhere, right? What is God's perspective? God's perspective is basically being able to see every point in space and time equally well, right? That's God's perspective. It's the perspective of infinity, if you imagine parallel lines emanating from all points. Okay, it's the kind of thing that gets kind of reproduced visually in terms of the vanishing point in linear perspective in painting, right, where all the objects are equally represented equally clearly on a single plane. That is kind of what these people mean when they mean God's point of view. Everything looks equally clear. Everything is, you know, as it were, equally proportioned. And why is this God's point of view? Well, because God's the creator and God doesn't mess around. Everything is there for a reason, right? So everything is equally valuable. Everything's equally important. Everything's equally relevant. That's kind of how they're translating this in spatio-temporal terms. Okay? That's the most concrete sense we've ever had, actually, of what it is to get into the mind of God and have God's point of view. Okay? And so what we do as human beings, in a sense, is we have an imperfect version of this. Okay? Where in some sense what we're doing is we're overestimating and overvaluing. You know, so if you go back to the pre-modern period, what's happening in the pre-modern period? People are overestimating, overvaluing the past. It's as if that's all they can see, in a sense, because that's the only thing they have any actually empirical contact with, or, you know, in inferentially through the empirical contact that others in the past have had. Whereas with regard to the future, right, people tend to underestimate what they potentially can know about this because they haven't had this kind of empirical contact. That's the way in which the modern mentality interprets how. So in other words, traditional people are too wedded to the empirical record. They're, as it were, too grounded in sensory knowledge. Whereas human beings are more than just the sum of the sensory knowledge they've had. Especially if you're a Christian, you believe you're created in the image and likeness of God. So that's, you know, that's where the theology comes in, right? You believe, in a sense, you know more than what's in fact been the sum total of the past, and that you can have, as it were, a more robust, more confident attitude with regard to dealing with the future, including the idea that it may be different. Okay, it doesn't need to repeat the past. Okay, and that's the crucial point. And so what is it that you imagine happens over time? You know, so what is the kind of view you have of whatever you want to call it, the history of knowledge, the history of science, that comes from this kind of perspective that I'm talking about here? Well, what you get when you start to think that the goal is to, as it were, understand the past as well as you understand the future, that is actually the godlike goal. You want to actually have epistemic parity between the two. Because that's God, that's what God has. Okay? And that's what we're aiming for. What does this mean in practice? Well, one of the things that it means in practice, and I've already been alluding to this, is that it means that you, in a way, try to curb yourself from overestimating the past, as a general rule. In other words, big events, things that make a big difference to people, especially close to the ground, from the standpoint of our understanding of knowledge and reality, these things may be very easily overestimated. And as a result, we may be, as it were, too grounded in them in order to be able to appreciate what kinds of horizons are open up to us, right, once we start to take this idea of predicting and controlling the future seriously. Okay? So what you're imagining happening over time isn't so much that we just learn more and more about stuff. That's not really the picture. The picture is, in a sense, what you do is you redistribute your sentiment, you might say. So in a sense, a lot of the things from the past that in a sense have acted as a kind of burden and have provided a kind of grounding for the way you think about things ends up getting removed. And in fact, you start to invest more in a future that may in fact be quite different from how the past has been. Okay, so there's this kind of redistribution of moral sentiment that I would say is the main consequence of following this thing I've been calling the proactionary standpoint, much more so than the sheer accumulation of knowledge, right? It's a redistribution of sentiment away from the past and toward the future, and as a result, leading to the kinds of investments, you know, that make people confident to want to participate in the creation and construction of the future. And I'll stop here, okay? I think that might be a good place to stop.